KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
A lot of heartbreak, house is completely gone, vehicles upside down, pets running here and there, and just chaos, just to be honest with you, sir.
Death and destruction in Missouri and Kentucky after overnight violent and fast-moving storms. For Saturday, May 17th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, how President Trump's meetings on his just-concluded foreign trip could reshape the Middle East. We'll check in on Poland's tight elections and warnings about warmer temperatures in Texas too early.
People thinking, oh my God, this is only May. Can you imagine what the summer will be?
Also, we'll hear why the U.S. is cutting back on millions of dollars in medical aid in Zambia.
I know it's going to be the poor family in rural Zambia whose baby gets malaria and they won't have access to anti-malarials.
Plus, this week's Reporter's Notebook, the challenges of covering China and how they've changed over time. First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. In California, federal and local officials are investigating a car explosion near a Palm Springs fertility clinic that's killed one person. Steve Futterman has more.
The explosion damaged the clinic along with several other nearby buildings. The Palm Springs fire chief says the blast appears to be an intentional act of violence. According to the mayor, it's unclear if the person killed was connected to the blast. The U.S. attorney who represents the Palm Springs area says the FBI is on the scene and investigating whether the explosion was deliberate. The FBI has deployed bomb technicians. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms is also sending agents to Palm Springs. On its website, the clinic describes itself as the area's first and only full-service fertility center. Its services include in vitro fertilization and egg freezing. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
At least 18 people are dead in Kentucky after severe storms and tornadoes last night. As Stan Ingold with member station WEKU reports, officials expect that number to continue to climb.
Governor Andy Beshear says he has spoken with Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem and officials with FEMA, and that they have vowed to help. He's also made an official request for a federal disaster declaration. Beshear, a Democrat who has often butted heads with the Trump administration, says politics have no place in natural disasters like this one.
For the two events that we've already had this year, we've seen a White House and a FEMA organization that has performed well and has done what we've asked.
FEMA officials are already on the ground helping with flooding disasters. This is the third major natural disaster to hit Kentucky this year. For NPR News, I'm Stan Ingold in Richmond, Kentucky.
And at least seven people are dead in Missouri from those storms. President Trump says he'll talk with Russian President Putin Monday morning, to be followed by a call with Ukrainian President Zelensky. This days after Putin skipped peace talks with Ukraine and Turkey. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben has more.
In a social media post, Trump said that he will talk to Putin by phone at 10 a.m. Monday, then talk to Zelensky and, quote, various members of NATO. This past week, Ukrainian and Russian officials met in Turkey for their first direct peace talks since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Zelensky had called for Putin to attend, but the Russian president did not go. On the campaign trail last year, Trump repeatedly said he would broker a peace deal between the two countries within 24 hours of taking office. Fighting has continued instead, and Trump has talked about wanting peace. After Russia sent missiles and drones to Ukraine in April, Trump posted on social media, "Vladimir, stop." Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
And JJ of Austria won Eurovision 2025 this year. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. It's the 71st anniversary of Brown v. the Board of Education, the Supreme Court decision that required the desegregation of public schools. But civil rights leaders warn that the country is on the verge of ending desegregation enforcement. NPR's Sandhya Dirks has more.
The Justice Department has already dismissed a desegregation order in a school district in Louisiana. Civil rights leaders worry more could follow. Janae Nelson, head of the Legal Defense Fund, says ending enforcement of Brown would render the ruling toothless.
Our public school system has never been fully desegregated, which means that we've never fully tapped into the promise of Brown.
Studies show that overall public schools are more segregated today than they were in the 1980s, and Nelson fears that the administration's actions will make it far worse. But the Trump administration and Louisiana Republicans say the orders are no longer needed and that they bog down districts in paperwork and legal fees. Cynthia Dirks, NPR News.
Journalism won the 150th running of the Preakness Stakes at Pimlico Racetrack in Baltimore, the second leg of the Triple Crown. The horse entered with 6-5 odds to take the $1.2 million prize. Gosger finished second and Sandman finished third. There is no Triple Crown winner this year because Kentucky Derby winner Sovereignty didn't race today. This is the final Preakness at that race course before renovations start at the track and are expected to take about 2 years. In the meantime, the Preakness will be held at nearby Laurel Park in Maryland. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's 6 minutes past the hour of four. KUAC is supported by Ice Age Charcuterie, offering a variety of locally sourced aged meats and curating charcuterie boards and grazie tables for any events. More information at iceagecharcuterie.com. Also, if you were interested in the Alaska Songbird, information and registration is available at aksongbird.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Powerful storms swept through several states last night, with much of the worst damage concentrated in Missouri and Kentucky. Five people died in Missouri. St. Louis Mayor Kara Spencer called the devastation, quote, truly tremendous, and said an estimated 5,000 buildings were impacted. And in Kentucky, the numbers are even worse. Governor Andy Beshear confirmed at least 18 people are dead, but has warned that number may grow. Many people are still unaccounted for as relief efforts continue. Laurel County, south of Lexington, was one of the hardest hit areas. Reporter John McGarry from member station WEKU is there and joins us. Hi, John.
Hi, Scott.
Where are you and what have you seen so far?
I'm in London, Kentucky, and that is a city with a population of maybe 7,500 in the county of Laurel. It's the county seat of Laurel. And what happened here last night is, cliche perhaps, but devastation, and it's sort of chaotic. In some areas that are torn apart, you know, a block away, everything is fine. And today's a nice sunny day, and it's surreal. That'd be another way to describe it.
Yeah.
Well, I talked to the Laurel County Sheriff, a gentleman named John Root, and he's been in law enforcement, he says, for 40 years. He's 59 years old. He's lived in this area his entire life. And this is how he describes what he saw.
We've been throughout the county at these sites, and it's a lot of damage, a lot of heartbreak. I mean, house is completely gone, vehicles upside down, pets running here and there, and just chaos, just to be honest with you, sir.
And this is the latest in just a really bad stretch of weather in Kentucky. You've had historic flooding in February and April, now these storms. What is the National Weather Service saying about what has caused this?
You know, I spoke with a meteorologist in the Jackson office in eastern Kentucky a few minutes ago, and he said, we haven't officially declared it a tornado, but it was a tornado. He says damage scars from satellite images taken by the NASA Terra satellite show this tornado went at least 50 miles, probably further. And you're right, Kentucky's had a terrible run of bad luck with weather. Because we go back to 2021 and the Western Kentucky tornado that devastated several communities and killed 57 people.
You know, one of the questions here was whether the local forecast office in Jackson, Kentucky was fully staffed, whether that played a role in the warnings that went out. What has the National Weather Service said about that?
Well, meteorologist Christian Castle with the National Weather Service office in Jackson says they were fully staffed overnight. As you mentioned, that office does serve Somerset, London, much of eastern Kentucky. Of course, the cuts to the National Weather Service by the Trump administration have resulted in overnight staffing shortages at some National Weather Service offices. And the New York Times reported earlier this week that federal cuts resulted in staffing cutbacks at the Jackson office. Now, I've reached out to NOAA on this, and they wouldn't answer the question of how many people have you let go. But Castle told us that normally on quiet weather nights, they're closed because of staffing issues from 1 a.m. to 7 a.m., but he says they bring in additional staff anytime they're expecting extreme weather. So probably some more questions to be answered on that front.
Yeah.
And the office's website does list the meteorologist in charge position as vacant.
Meanwhile, the day after a storm, people are just trying to assess how bad things are. They're looking for survivors, trying to clean up. How are relief efforts going from what you can see?
Yeah, the relief efforts are going on in at least two sites here in London. And at the second I visited, South Laurel High School, Heather Lynn, who helped organize a massive donations, spoke about the community pulling together.
We're a very tight-knit community, and when something goes wrong, we all pull together as one, and we always build back.
So they're going to be set up for several days, no doubt, as people come to get food and perhaps a place to sleep. You know, it's a mess.
That is John McGarry from WEKU covering the deadly storms in Kentucky. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
The highlights from President Trump's visit to the Middle East this week were big business deals and lucrative contracts with Gulf countries. But there was also a surprise, a meeting with Syrian President Ahmed al-Shara, the first time a Syrian leader met with a U.S. president in 25 years. In the meeting, Trump vowed to lift U.S. sanctions, though that decision would ultimately rest with Congress. And then he went further. He said Syria may even possibly recognize Israel as a sovereign state. To understand all of these complexities further, we are joined by NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi in Tel Aviv. Thanks for coming on the show.
Of course.
This was a surprise meeting. It was on the sidelines of Trump's trip. What all happened?
So, Scott, can we actually just take a minute first? President Ahmed al-Shara is a man who once had a $10 million bounty on his head. You know, the U.S. used to say that this guy was a terrorist. And now the president of the United States is shaking his hand. So that this meeting even happened is just remarkable. So when they met, the White House said that Trump urged Shah to do three main things. Get rid of all, quote, foreign terrorists from Syria, help the U.S. stamp out any resurgence of ISIS, and to diplomatically recognize Israel. And after that, Trump announced that he vowed to lift the sanctions.
I mean, like we said before, that would ultimately come down to Congress. But still, it's a remarkable statement from an American president. If they were lifted, what exactly would that mean for Syria?
I mean, Syria could just start to rebuild again. You know, those sanctions were seriously crippling and lasted more than two decades. And, you know, when I drove into Damascus a couple of days after Assad fell in December, I could really see the effects of the sanctions. The buildings are falling apart. So many cars are ancient because parts are unavailable. You know, we'd pay for coffee with these huge wads of cash because the currency meant nothing. So getting sanctions lifted was a huge win for Shara and one thing off his to-do list. He also has to prove to the world that his fighting days are over and that he can make Syria a stable part of the region. And that means also making peace with its neighbor, Israel.
And Israel is a country that is deeply invested in this as well. How is the response in Israel to these statements from Trump?
Well, Israel was kind of stunned when they heard that Trump vowed to lift the sanctions. Israeli media was reporting that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was urging Trump not to. You see, Israel's line all along has been that Shara and his people are terrorists and that Israel must defend itself from them. Immediately after the fall of Assad in December, Israeli forces seized a buffer zone between the two countries that was set up in 1974. And then it also was bombing hundreds of military targets inside Syria. Lately, Israel's also been expanding past that buffer zone further into Syria and continuing its bombing campaign in and around Damascus. But, you know, with all of that, Syria is still saying it wants peace with Israel. Shara has said it publicly many times. And, you know, just this past Wednesday, Syrian official spokesperson Ali Rifai spoke to Khan News, Israel's public media network. Now, first of all, just the fact that a Syrian government official spoke to Israeli media is incredible. You know, it would have been unthinkable just 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. But Rifai said that Israel should retreat from Syrian territory and the buffer zone, but that it's ready for peace.
Well, when we talk about things that President Trump is promising, it's important to put in the context that over the past decade, there have been so many big promises that would be groundbreaking that just never materialized. But still, what he's talking about in this meeting is a really big deal. He's talking about full normalization here.
I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, Trump said he told Shetta in the meeting, "I hope you'll join the Abraham Accords when Syria is ready." And according to Trump, Shetta replied, "Yes." Now, it's one thing, like you said, to make peace, but to go full-blown normalization with Israel and sign these accords, that would make some serious history.
Can you step back and remind us of what the Abraham Accords are?
Sure. So the Abraham Accords are these bilateral agreements normalizing relations between Arab countries and Israel, and they're all mediated by the United States. So far, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco have all signed the agreements, and Saudi Arabia is close to being the fifth. Under the agreement, they all recognize Israel as a sovereign nation. There are diplomatic ties, flights between the countries, and of course, these major business deals.
How likely do you think this is to happen? What needs to happen between now and these big steps, given the long history between Syria and Israel?
Yeah, I mean, all of this is really just talk right now. It's remarkable talk, but it's talk. You know, and if it was going to happen, Syria would have conditions first. You know, a big one is for Israel to retreat from Syrian land. They'll also want to discuss Gaza and the possibility of a Palestinian state. Abdullah Al-Ghadawi is a Syrian analyst and journalist. He says at least the political will for Syria to sign the Abraham Accords is there. So Ghadawi says first Syria has to prove itself and create the stable economy. Then the government can move forward with such a monumental move like normalizing ties with Israel. So if this is going to happen, it's going to take a long time.
I mean, Israel, it seems like, would really benefit from this. Is the country saying it's on board?
Well, on peace with Syria, officially there's no comment yet from Israel. But Shara did confirm that there have been indirect mediated talks with Israel recently to discuss security. You know, there are members in the Israeli cabinet who still see Shara as a terrorist, but there are others who are being more pragmatic. You know, they say we're entering this new era of the Middle East, you know, Saudi Arabia possibly normalizing with Israel, the fall of the Assad regime. So, and they also lately have been feeling like they've been sidelined by Trump and they want back in. And so many say that this could be a way to do that. Also, peace between the two countries would mean Israel could secure its border against a once sworn enemy and perhaps avoid another attack on its land, like on October 7th, 2023. It would also mean that the route of weapons from Iran to Hezbollah through Syria would be cut off.
I mean, that would be quite a different Middle East. Is it fair to say that this meeting between Trump and Shara kickstarted all of this?
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, there are all these lucrative deals, weapon sales and contracts. But, you know, for Trump, it's also about his legacy. I spoke to Middle East scholar Thomas Warwick from the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C., and he said all of this was very much on Trump's mind.
The leaders who made peace between Israel and Egypt won the Nobel Prize. Everyone realizes the Nobel Committee would undoubtedly recognize the leaders who made peace between Israel and Syria. So this is very much in the cards.
So look, yes, it's all talk right now. But Trump has long been obsessed with winning this Nobel Prize. You know, he even brought it up last February when he told Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the Oval Office that he deserved it.
I feel like I remember during one of his campaigns, crowds chanting Nobel, Nobel mm-hmm. during his rallies.
Exactly.
It's been something that's long in his mind.
He really wants it.
That was NPR's Hadil Alshalchi in Tel Aviv. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Efforts to eliminate public media have reached an all-time high. KUAC could lose the ability to deliver life-saving emergency alerts, essential local programming, and educational resources you rely on. And it's up to us to protect it. Learn more at protectmypublicmedia.org.
It's up to all of us to protect public media. This afternoon, we have mostly sunny skies here in Fairbanks with a high near 65 and calm wind. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low of around 44, southwest wind around 5 miles per hour, becoming calm.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. More than two dozen people are dead in severe storms in Kentucky, Missouri, and Virginia last night that brought heavy rains, gusty winds, and tornadoes in some areas. Officials are assessing the damage in those states and warn that the death toll could rise. President Trump says he'll talk by phone to Russian President Putin and later Ukrainian President Zelensky Monday about ending Russia's war in Ukraine. This after the first direct talks between the two countries in more than 3 years failed to lead to a ceasefire. And the Trump administration says it will allow the sale of forced reset triggers, which makes a semi-automatic weapon fire more rapidly. The Justice Department says it reached a settlement that ends the ban as part of a deal that also requires it to return seized devices. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Voters in Poland will cast their votes for a new president on Sunday. Observers say the closely fought election is the most important one in a generation for a country that has one of the best economic growth records in the world and one of the biggest militaries in Europe. NPR's Central Europe correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
Long live Poland is the chant among thousands of supporters of Poland's far-right Law and Justice Party marching through Warsaw's Old Town, many of them dressed in the red and white colors of the national flag. Their chant morphs into a different one, Tusk to Berlin, a call for Prime Minister Donald Tusk, whose centrist civic coalition took control of parliament from Law and Justice in a surprise election win 2 years ago, to flee to Germany, Poland's western neighbor, who many right-wing voters blame for Europe's problems. The presidential solution for this patriotic crowd is Law and Justice candidate Karol Nawrocki, an historian turned politician who demands reparations from Germany for its crimes against Poland in World War II. Polacy nigdy nie oddadzą swojej wolności. It is time, says Nawrocki to his flag-waving supporters, for us to nurture our heritage and refuse to let our freedom be taken away and our sovereignty to be given up. Heritage, sovereignty, buzzwords among Law and Justice politicians who believe the open progressive policies of the European Union are watering down Poland's national and cultural identity. Justyna Krawczynska rests her Polish flag on her shoulder to tell me that this election is an existential one for Poland, when she says that Nawrocki needs to win to ensure Poland's sovereignty.
Wielkie, wielkie podziękowania, że pamiętacie. Dziękuję wam bardzo.
Hundreds of kilometers southeast of Warsaw, in Białowa, a city along the border of Belarus, the frontrunner for the Polish presidency, Warsaw Mayor Rafał Trzaskowski, gives a speech at a campaign rally. Anyone with common sense knows we need a strong European Union, says Trzaskowski, and a strong Polish role within that union. A strong NATO and a strong EU mean a strong Poland and a secure Poland, he says. After the rally, Wiesław Rubaj and Krzysztof Kuczynski, both retired Air Force pilots, lingered. Trzaskowski is an educated worldly man, speaks several languages, and even served in the European Parliament, says Kuczynski. He was Vice Minister of European Integration. He has a broad view of the world, and he says we need that in a leader. On the other side, we have Nawrocki and his party. All they're trying to do, he says, is push people back into church. Andrzej Bobiński, managing director of Polityka Insight, says that as an ally of Prime Minister Donald Tusk, there's a lot of pressure on Trzaskowski to win this race.
This is make or break for Tusk and for the counter-revolution that this ruling coalition has brought about.
That's because, he says, Tusk's government has become unpopular with many Poles, and much like there's been in the rest of Europe, the popularity of the far right in Poland is again on the rise. Bobiński says there's a lot that can happen in the time before Poland's next parliamentary election in 2027.
But if I were to guess, I'd guess that there's going to be a right-wing, or even an extremely right-wing government in 2027, then the president is super important as somebody who will be basically checking the next government and will be an important safeguard of the constitutional order.
Latest polls show that Trzaskowski's European vision for Poland is winning out among voters. He's ahead of Nawrocki by at least 5%, but a third candidate from the Libertarian Konfederacja Party will likely mean no single candidate will get a majority, forcing a runoff election on June 1st. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Poland.
The heat is on in Texas, where a spring heat wave has broken May temperature records in some parts of the state. And that is not the only place where heat is an issue. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the planet's 10 warmest years since 1850 have all occurred in the past decade, with 2024 being the hottest year on record so far. And experts say heat this early in the year can be especially risky. NPR's Climate Desk reporter Alejandra Barunda explains why.
Adelita Cantu lives in San Antonio, Texas, where it is currently sweltering around 100 degrees. And it's humid, too.
So even though we may be like hit 100, it's going to feel like 105, 106.
Texans are definitely not strangers to heat. But Cantu is a public health nurse at the University of Texas Health San Antonio. And she knows that heat like this is particularly dangerous when it comes early in the heat season. And it's not just Texas. This is increasingly a problem across the United States. Tess Wiskel is an emergency physician at Harvard University outside of Boston. She has seen the emergency room fill up during early season heat waves, even when the temperatures don't seem super high.
You tend to see outdoor workers getting sicker faster, and we tend to see athletes and other people like that.
Wiskel says that happens because people's bodies haven't yet gone through a process called acclimatization. That can take a couple weeks of heat exposure as bodies make some key changes.
It will sweat earlier to help cool you off when you're acclimatized. Your whole blood volume is going to change when you're acclimatized, and all of these things help protect you from heat.
So early in the year, a lot of people's bodies haven't done that yet. That means a higher risk of heat exhaustion, heat stroke, even heart problems. A study from 2010 found that the risk of dying from heat during the first heat wave of the year was roughly doubled.
When you're at the beginning of a heat season, something that you might have been used to by the end of the summer or by the end of the heat season, your body is not yet prepared for.
Climate change is making the heat season stretch longer and start earlier. The Southwest now sees nearly 3 weeks more above average spring days than in the 1970s. Pat Kinney is a climate and health expert at Boston University.
What we call the warm season is spreading out over more months. You know, it's not just, you know, June, July, and August. It's like May, June, July, August, and September, and maybe even further out, you know, in some places.
Cantu is definitely worried about that issue, too. How long heat season is going to last?
People thinking, oh, my God, this is only May. Can you imagine what the summer will be? So there's that, some of that, I don't say depression, but sadness setting in as well. Oh, my God, this is going to be a long, hot summer.
So for everyone in Texas and the rest of the country, it's time to start acclimatizing to the heat that's coming. Alejandra Barunda, NPR News.
During the U.S. Supreme Court's arguments this week on birthright citizenship, one legal concept took center stage: nationwide injunctions. This is when a single federal judge blocks the president from implementing a certain policy. And they have been front and center in the news this year as various groups have sued to block orders and other actions by the Trump administration. Long before this week's arguments, though, one law professor had argued that these injunctions are a serious problem. Nicholas Bagley is a law professor at the University of Michigan and a former chief legal counsel to Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. He's made this case in articles in The Atlantic and elsewhere and joins me now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
I'm very happy to be here.
Nationwide injunctions, what is the general purpose of them from a court's perspective? What do they do?
Yeah, from a court's perspective, when they encounter a law or a policy that they think is unconstitutional or illegal, they think that the president has exceeded his authority or an agency has overstepped. In those cases, a nationwide injunction is a way to put that policy or that law on ice as to the entire country. And what that does is it prevents the policy from taking effect and hurting anybody who might be subject to the policy in the meantime.
You're a Democrat, you're a progressive, right?
Yep.
Many progressives around the country have been grateful to these injunctions for stopping what they see as illegal and dangerous actions taken by the Trump administration. And yet you are continuing to make the case that actually this is a flawed system. Walk me through your thinking.
Well, so nationwide injunctions are useful if you are an opponent to the person who sits in the White House. There's no doubt about that. And especially if you're concerned about the kind of brazen unconstitutionality that it characterizes a lot of President Trump's actions, then, you know, it's pretty hard to make the argument you should drop this weapon. But the thing about nationwide injunctions is they're equal opportunity offenders. When Biden was president, Democrats were deploring all of the nationwide injunctions that would issue from single-judge courthouses in Texas, really out of Amarillo, Texas, in many cases. And so if they were a problem during the Biden administration, you want to pause and think before defending them just because they're opportunistically useful against Donald Trump.
You know, I've done a lot of legal coverage of stuff related to President Trump when he was running for office again, when he was back in office. And I feel like I would often come across the situation where people are making these legal arguments that kind of assume that everything is being done within the usual guardrails. And yet in the specific instance we're talking about, it's President Trump operating way outside those guardrails. Your argument takes that into consideration. You're saying even if somebody is doing something that many experts say is wildly unconstitutional, you're still sticking in this lane that this is not the way to deal with that.
If somebody's behaving wildly unconstitutional, should we then encourage the courts to behave in a way we think is long-term counterproductive and, in fact, exceeds the court's authority? You know, one way to think about it is that right now I think there's a good case that our democracy has misfired and that the traditional checks on executive branch action have weakened. Nationwide injunctions aren't a terribly good response to that. They don't, you know, encourage you to vote for better presidents. They actually don't do as much to restrain out-of-line presidential action as the traditional course of judicial lawmaking. And in the meantime, you know, if you endorse them, they're going to come back to bite you the next time you take office and in perfectly good faith seek to exercise your powers to protect the American public. So, you know, look, it's an awkward time to defend nationwide injunctions if you're a Democrat, but Trump really is temporary. And when he's gone, we want to make sure that we're thinking hard about the kinds of structures that best enable us to govern effectively.
I'd love to get your response to something that Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson asked the government during arguments about this.
It seems to me that your argument says we get to keep on doing it until everyone who is potentially harmed by it figures out how to file a lawsuit, hire a lawyer, et cetera. And I don't understand how that is remotely consistent with the rule of law.
What did you make of that point?
I think it's a bit overstated, to be honest. I mean, it is true that not getting a nationwide injunction means that during the time that a particular issue is getting litigated, there will be people who could be harmed by an unconstitutional or unlawful policy. So that trade-off is real. But at the same time, lots of people are going to be protected, not because of an injunction that a judge enters, but because the courts themselves will develop precedent that binds in the circuits in which the courts of appeals sit, and finally at the U.S. Supreme Court when they issue a decision that will apply nationwide. And as to those court decisions, the Trump administration will abide by them. What that means is that, you know, as these cases progress, there will be people who aren't able to take advantage of the very first judgment that's entered. But as precedent accrues and accumulates, as we get more decisions from courts of appeals in the U.S. Supreme Court, people really will be able to take advantage of those precedents. And eventually the question will be resolved for everyone. Most of them will never have to file a lawsuit. And that's true even if universal injunctions are taken off the table.
And you think when it comes to the steadiness of the law, that's a trade-off that's worth it than a more thorough airing?
It's a trade-off that's worth it. You know, we have a system that allows the hard legal questions to percolate in a bunch of different circuits before we get a conclusive resolution of the question. Nationwide injunctions short-circuit that regular process. What they do is they say the first judge to enter a nationwide injunction, that's the only decision that matters. And immediately, the federal government then has to take an appeal up to the Court of Appeals, and if it loses there, immediately up to the Supreme Court. So really important questions, questions that are hard, questions that divide legal scholars, that divide judges. Those questions can be rocketed up to the Supreme Court on really thin briefing very quickly. It also gives a huge incentive to partisan actors to file these lawsuits because all they have to do is win once. You file in a hospitable courthouse where you think you might draw a judge that's ideologically aligned, and boom, you win. And all of a sudden, every single major policy that any president of either political party makes is subject to a judicial referendum by the most ideologically motivated judges on the bench. And that seems like a really bad way to run a judicial system.
That is law professor Nicholas Bagley. Thank you so much.
Happy to do it.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. So here's a question. How much have you moved today? For a lot of us, the answer is very little. Maybe we got into the car, walked a short distance to the office, or maybe we've barely left the couch. The thing is, our bodies love movement, and we make a point of taking a walk after dinner or going for a jog or dancing in the living room. We see the benefits. Our guts feel better, we sleep better, we have more energy, our blood sugar is better regulated, our moods improve. NPR's Life Kit has been looking at how we can fit more movement into our busy days. Here's Life Kit host Mariel Segarra.
Maybe you're not moving or exercising much because you feel like you don't have time. I'm here to tell you that if you can't carve out an hour for a spin workout, that's fine. Try smaller movement breaks instead.
Your free time is likely going to show up in pockets that are much smaller than you were anticipating, but are meaty, you know, if you really look at them and put them together.
Katie Bowman is a biomechanist who studies how forces and motion affect the body and co-author of the book, I Know I Should Exercise, But... She says we can seize those small moments of downtime throughout the day.
You got someplace early and you now have 7 minutes or 12 minutes. Tune into that, set this as an intention or a cue that anytime you find yourself sort of sitting idly in your car, you're going to get up and you're going to get out and you're just going to move around, go for a very brief walk. You can hop in place. You can reach up and touch the top of the car.
Sometimes I do calf raises when I'm brushing my teeth because I always remember to brush my teeth.
When you've got something that happens regularly in your day and you tether movement to that, then that occurrence in your day becomes the reminder.
Have some fun with this. Martinez Evans is a marathon runner and author of the book Slow AF Run Club, the ultimate guide for anyone who wants to run. And he says, for example, if you're taking care of your child...
Look, grab a kid and do some air squats. Use them as a weight. Now you got a 10 to 15 pound weight. Hold your baby out and curl them with your biceps. Kiss them. Like, that's the thing about exercise. Like, all of this is cumulative and all of it is beneficial.
You can also use behavioral science techniques to stay motivated. Try temptation bundling, pairing your exercise with an activity you like, for instance, watching your favorite TV show, and only watch the show when you work out. Katie Milkman is a professor at the Wharton School of Business who researches behavioral change.
My research has shown that it can increase the rate at which people exercise if they combine a real pleasure that they look forward to with their workouts. So you're not allowed to watch The Crown unless you're at the gym. That's the idea. And as a result, you're going to start craving trips to the gym to see the next episode, and you won't feel any guilt about spending time watching TV because you'll be working out.
Okay, lastly, the best kind of exercise is the kind that you will actually do. For me, it's running outside, using my stationary bike, doing yoga at home, and going rock climbing. Because it makes me feel like a secret agent scaling the walls on a special mission. Take yourself seriously when you're bored or you're dreading a certain kind of exercise. And if there's a kind of movement you find intriguing, try it out. It could become your favorite way to move. For NPR News, I'm Mariel Segarra.
For more Life Kit, go to npr.org/lifekit. This is NPR News.
37 years ago, students at Gallaudet refused to accept a non-deaf university president and shut their campus down.
You don't know me. Bye-bye.
Throughout this protest, we were taking back our power, our Deaf identity, and our pride.
Now, DeMarco's new documentary, Deaf President Now, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
And that'll be coming up tomorrow morning from 7 to 9 right here on KUAC. KUAC is supported by the Fairbanks Concert Association. Season tickets are available June 2nd for the 2025-26 season at fairbanksconcert.org. The Fairbanks Concert Association is supported in part by a grant from the Alaska State Council on the Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. If you are in Nome, you're experiencing a few clouds and 36 degrees.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Trump today blasted retail giant Walmart after its CEO said it would have to raise prices to account for Trump's hike on global tariffs. Trump said on social media that Walmart should, quote, eat the tariffs and that he would be watching. Iran's president says his country will continue nuclear talks with the U.S., but that it won't give in to threats over what he says are Iran's legitimate rights. Tehran's enrichment of uranium is a major sticking point between Iran and the U.S. And the Sunday Times of London newspaper is out with its annual list of the richest Britons, and it says King Charles barely makes the cut, coming in at 238th out of 350 people. That's despite his $850 million fortune being nearly double that of his late mom. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. And from Subaru, the new Forester Hybrid offers symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 581 miles per tank, part of the new Forester Hybrid family of SUVs. More at Subaru.com/ForesterHybrid. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. This year has brought a stream of bad news for many African countries as the Trump administration cut billions of dollars in foreign aid, often shutting down programs entirely and on short notice. Recently, the U.S. ambassador to Zambia announced yet another cut in assistance, but the reason for this cut was different, and it triggered very mixed feelings from people in Zambia. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel has the story.
The mood was somber when Ambassador Michael Gonzalez sat down at a press conference. He described his shock in 2021 when he discovered that medications the U.S. had donated to Zambia were being stolen and resold for a profit.
From 2021 through late 2023, our buyers visited more than 2,000 pharmacies in every province and district of this country.
Almost all the pharmacies had stolen goods on their shelves. Roughly half had meds that the U.S. itself had donated to Zambia, where more than half the country's population lives below the poverty line. Gonzalez said he's spent the past year begging Zambian officials to stop the theft, but he says there's been only minimal action. So now he's cutting $50 million in U.S. aid to Zambia for medications and medical supplies. This is unrelated to Trump's sweeping aid cuts earlier this year.
I view this as a heart-wrenching worst-case scenario. I've lost sleep over this. I've cried over this.
Wiping away tears at the press conference, Gonzalez said it was a hard choice because he knew it would not be those getting rich from the theft who would suffer.
I know it's going to be the poor family in rural Zambia whose baby gets malaria and they won't have access to anti-malarials. It breaks my heart. But I also have a duty to the American people, to the American taxpayer.
After the cut was announced, the Zambian Minister of Health, Elijah Muchima, posted a statement on social media.
The Zambian government wishes to reaffirm its commitment to resolving this unfortunate issue.
He admitted this is a long-standing problem and argued that his government is taking action, including suspending or removing several senior members of Zambia's medical supply agency. But many Zambians are not satisfied, including Chris Zumani Zimba, a local political analyst.
In the eyes of many Zambians today, the United States government is being seen as a hero government. It is exposing gross corruption in the public health sector.
At the same time, he says the cut in aid is creating a sense of fear among those who rely on U.S. aid.
It was like declaring a funeral in advance in many households who depend on those life-saving drugs.
Theft of donated drugs has happened before, says Paul Spiegel of Johns Hopkins.
Corruption in general is not unusual, whether it be high-income countries like the U.S. or Europe or low-income countries.
But relative to all the aid that's given globally, he says the amount that's misused is very small. He says what makes this announcement noteworthy is that it stands in stark contrast to Trump's very abrupt halt to foreign aid. Instead, this particular cut isn't taking effect until the end of 2025, so that the Zambian government has time to find alternative funding.
It's done with a plan in mind to reduce the suffering, and that is not what is happening in this current administration whatsoever. It's quite the opposite.
Still, he says it's a cut in aid, and the health consequences for many Zambians could be dire. Gabriella Emmanuel, NPR News.
Imagine a cluster of buildings the size of 100 football fields. Now imagine more than 20,000 businesses inside, hawking their wares to another 200,000 potential customers. This is the Canton Fair in the southern Chinese city of Guangzhou, the biggest trade show in the world.
If it's made in China, you can get it there. Hair dryers, headphones, hard hats, tools, tractors, yarn, electric wires, everything.
And this is John Ruich, correspondent who covers China for NPR.
One booth we went to had this sound, and we went and checked it out, and it's these electric, like, they look like tennis rackets. They're electric bug zappers.
John has been to the Canton Fair numerous times over the decades he has covered China, but this year, it was different.
I've sometimes had difficulty getting people to open up, and this time, everybody was willing to talk, pretty much.
It was mid-April, about a week after President Trump's so-called Liberation Day, when he put tariffs on just about every country on Earth, with China receiving the highest tariffs by far. It was a seismic shock to many people at the Canton Fair, including Stephen Zhang, sales manager for a mini oven manufacturer.
And he told me at the time that 90% of his business comes from the U.S. And so after the tariffs were jacked up to 145%, they shut down. They had an executive meeting and then basically told all the workers, I think he said they have 100 workers or something like that, to go home. Their pay would be cut. And they moved into a wait-and-see mode.
That uncertainty would continue for about a month, until earlier this week when the U.S. and China reached a new agreement to lower tariffs. So a couple of days ago, John and his producer checked back in with Stephen Zhang.
They got the factory back up to about 70 or 80% of capacity, put 90% of the workers back on the factory line.
That quickly?
That quickly. They just turned around, called these people up, apparently, and said, come back into work. But he says they lost about half of their U.S. clients in this. Smaller companies went out of business. People haven't been placing orders. Interestingly, for the products that he makes, they still face a 50% tariff, which is quite high. He says the future, you know, they're up and running again, but the future is uncertain.
This is the whiplash of trying to run a business in China during this ongoing trade war. It's also the whiplash of trying to cover China as a foreign correspondent right now. So today, for our weekly Reporter's Notebook segment, John Ruich takes us behind the scenes as he tries to make sense of this unprecedented moment. I'm glad we're talking to you right now because the U.S.-China trade relationship is one of the biggest stories in the world right now. And I will say, like, this is not an area I have extensively covered, and I often find it hard to comprehend, but you have been covering this for a really long time. You've been covering it up close. You understand these scenes. I want you to take us to a different scene that you've reported on, another side of the Chinese economy, an auto show in Shanghai. Tell us what you saw there.
Yes. A few weeks ago, we went to the Shanghai Auto Show, which happens once every 2 years. This is another one of those things where it's an event in China that's laced with superlatives, right? This is one of the biggest car shows in the world. The place where it's being held might even be bigger than where the Canton Fair is held. It's just this vast location. But what we saw there is the biggest car market in the world, sort of revving on all cylinders, mm-hmm. right? It's ironic because there's no cylinders, right? It's the biggest EV market in the world. NEVs now make up more than 50% of new cars sold in China. In the US, by comparison, it's under 20%. And this technology in Shanghai at this car show was on full display. There were drones for cars. There were cars that looked like drones. There were flat screens everywhere. You know where the side mirror is in a car? Like, mm-hmm. apparently the thing that's coming, and I don't know if U.S. regulations allow this yet, but in China, it's a camera now that aims back down the side of the car, and there's a little screen on the side that you look at.
So it's not a mirror. It's just digital?
It's digital.
Yeah. Wow. That would be disorienting. I don't know. I don't know if I need that technology.
You'll need it. Yeah, you don't know it now.
10 years,
you
will need it. I couldn't live without this.
I can't believe I didn't have this. But you know, there were American brands there. Chrysler, Ford, Cadillac was there, but they were vastly outnumbered by Chinese brands. And I guess ultimately what that says about China, the economy is complex, it faces hurdles, but you really get the sense, there is real strong entrepreneurial spirit, hustle, that you see at these trade shows, which again are just a slice of life in a country like this, but you can feel it there.
Let's back up a bit. How long have you been reporting in China at this point?
Ooh, yeah. My first reporting assignment to China was in 2001.
Wow. So you've been there a while, and there has been drastic, drastic, drastic change in this country over the time that you've been reporting on it.
Yes, that's safe to say.
I think, like, as a foreign correspondent, you're trying to do two things that are really tricky, and I want to talk about them one at a time. The first is trying to report as an American journalist for an American news outlet. You're trying to report in a country where NPR is not necessarily top of mind. The American news ecosystem is not necessarily top of mind. And there's at times an adversarial tense relationship between the U.S. and China. Can you tell us how you go about your reporting, how you frame things, how you're typically received by people when you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I have to say that people in China are generally quite warm when I introduce myself, when they learn that I'm American. The ease of reporting there varies. Sometimes it can be quite difficult and hostile. It can be a challenging environment. It depends on the story. It depends on the political sensitivities at the moment. It depends on the timing. In 2023, the government launched an anti-espionage campaign. And I remember, you know, a couple of people that we reached out to or attempted to talk to, one or two people were unwilling. They just couldn't trust us. Mm-hmm. Late in the COVID period, when China was still locked down, the rest of the world was open, there was great frustration in the country. People seemed very open to venting their frustration to us.
All right, so that is one of the big challenges of being a foreign correspondent. And the other, I think, is in a way is harder, actually, and that is taking this really complicated story that you live in and experience every single day and telling it in a way that brings our audience along if they haven't been closely following it. Also trying to make it compelling and interesting and tell an engaging story. And that can be tricky, especially when you're so in deep on a complicated story. How do you think about your pieces when you're sitting down to write them?
Yeah, there's two sides of this. One is that there's news that needs to be covered. There's geopolitics, there's macroeconomics, there's political, you know, change wherever, right? In parts of China, there's events that happen which we need to cover. Beyond that, I think at NPR we have kind of a special position, right, within Western media, within the U.S. media, in that we can put voices of people from afar into the ears of American listeners. So to the greatest extent possible, I'm searching for, and in China looked for, personal stories. And sort of one of the things that I've tried to do is pretty simple, but it's to tell stories featuring interesting people, maybe ordinary people, and getting their voices on the air so that American audiences hear them and recognize humans on the other side of the globe. I had a fascinating conversation with a disabled poet a few months ago who was branching out into dance, actually. So we saw her dance show. The stage is a very long way from Yu's roots in a farming village in central China. But Yu has been catapulted to unlikely national fame by poems like... We traveled to this far-flung sort of part of the center, sort of west, sort of central part of the country, to the Yangtze River, where we interviewed a guy who was playing piano to sort of process his grief from the pandemic.
For 大概在2022年的夏天，然后我就梦到我爸爸。
In the summer of 2022, I dreamt of my father. I really missed him. He'd been gone over 2 years. And I wanted to do something for him because nobody talked about him anymore.
He decided to perform the song in public, on the street.
So you said you filed your first story around 2001 or so, but that wasn't the first time you were in China. You'd been there, what, a decade before for the first time?
My first trip to China was in 92, and I went to the city of Kunming in southern China, in Yunnan province. And it was a different place back then, I tell you.
I mean, what is the best way to think about, to envision just how much this country has changed since you first experienced it, since you first started reporting on it today?
I mean, China's economy back then was 2-3% the size of what it is today, something like that. The reform and opening and the Chinese economic miracle, quote unquote, as we know it today, hadn't even really started then. I know that reform and opening started at the end of the 70s, but it hit a big speed bump in 1989 after the crackdown on protesters in Tiananmen Square. There was bikes everywhere. Everybody talks about, it used to be bikes everywhere. There were bikes everywhere. Nobody had a personal car. People dreamed of having a personal car back then. And now, Shanghai Auto Show.
So that's looking backward. So much is changing. You have these big long-term technological trends. You have these big long-term economic trends. You have this trade war that we truly don't know how it's going to turn out. Given all that, like, what do you think is next? What do you think is the next big story, the story you have the biggest questions about when it comes to China and its economy?
Scott, are you asking for investment advice?
If I am, then we have to do one of those fun disclaimers at the end. Like...
I mean, this place and the economy, you know, the parable of the blind men touching the elephant, right? Mm-hmm. Each touches a different part. It's different where you look. So I don't know what's next, you know, going back to 1992, my first trip there, or 2001, when I moved there as a journalist with Reuters. There was always this sense of confidence in the future, confidence that China was getting better, confidence that, you know, my life today is 10 times better than my parents' life. My parents' life was 10 times better than their parents' life. And my kids' life is going to be 10 times better than mine. Mm-hmm. I think that has been challenged in people's minds. And if and when that can get turned around, unlocked, if they can reinvigorate that confidence in the future of the Chinese economy, great for the economy. If not, it's a more complex place to cover, to think about, to make predictions about.
Yeah. John Ruich, NPR's China correspondent. I always enjoy it when we take our conversations off Slack. Thanks for explaining your beat to us.
I'm happy to do it. Good to chat with you.
Saturday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. From the University at Buffalo, the University at Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org. We'll be right back.
Golden Gate. You let no stranger wait outside your door.